I preached here so many times, I don't mind sharing with you, it's like family when I come back, and that is the most emotional hymn for me, so I'm just trying to keep it together. That hymn actually makes the gospel reading for today understandable for me, because today, frankly, when I chose these readings from the Catholic lectionary, I struggled with this gospel reading. The line that specifically called me, though, was the Jews disputed, or they quarreled. They were having a discussion about what Jesus was meaning. And how does he respond? He responds with what can be considered outlandish rhetoric about eating his body, drinking his blood. Are we to believe that they understood what he was saying? If you jump ahead to next Sunday's reading, the passages that just follow this reading from John, verses 60 to 69, the disciples take off just where I was. Jesus, this is really hard to get. I don't understand what you're talking about. But he doesn't pull any punches. You know what he says? He says, you think this language shocks you? How are you going to react if you see the Son of Man ascend to heaven? I'm talking about the spiritual life. Some of you just aren't going to get it. And you know, right? You know what? Some of them didn't get it, and they left. Jesus still took it to the disciples, and he said, are you going to leave too? Do you want to leave? Go ahead. Go now. Simon Peter said, oh, no, no, I get it. You're talking about the spiritual life. Your words are of eternal life. End of discussion. Now, do we really think the disciples understood what Jesus was talking about? Did you understand what Jesus was talking about? About eating his body, drinking his blood? It's crazy talk. It's difficult to understand. Disciples probably didn't understand it. Did they accept it? Did they believe what Jesus said? Well, it seems yes. It seems like they did accept it. At least Simon Peter said, yes, okay, yeah, I get it. That's where the recorded discussion ends in the Gospel of John. Now, with all due respect to our Lord Jesus Christ, this is the problem with perfection. When you are perfect, or when people perceive you as being perfect, conversation tends to end. Questions tend to stop. People leave, or they stop talking. No one questions you when they think you're perfect. But we humans are not perfect. Each of us is a complex combination of right and wrong, virtues and errors, which we might call sin, weakness and strengths. Even saints are not perfect. Paramahansa Yogananda, who is the founder of the Self-Realization Fellowship, says this about saints. A saint is a sinner who never gives up. I like that. A saint is a sinner who never gives up. In the Christian tradition, a saint is not someone who's perfect. No. A saint is a human being. Saints are complex figures who can open up conversations about our lives of faith, open up our dialogue about our lives of faith through their faults, through their foibles, through their doubts, through their sins, in addition to their achievements and their gifts. It's up to us, the faithful, to engage with the stories of their lives and not presume that they're perfect and not to presume that we're supposed to think that they're perfect. Because once we start making that presumption, then we either leave, we leave the church, leave the discussion, we fall silent, we might dismiss the discussion. In general, we just shut down. So I would like to apply these thoughts that I have about sanctity with the upcoming canonization of Junipero Serra on September 23rd. As you know, he's a Franciscan priest of the 18th century. He's the founder of 9 out of the 21 California missions. If you're from California, if you live in California, even if you visit California, it's hard to miss the legacy of Junipero Serra, at least along the coastline. The physical vestiges of his lifetime work is still present in the physical missions. If you grew up in California, likely, and went to public schools in fourth grade, you probably studied the missions. How many of you went through public schools in California and studied the missions? A few of you did. I attribute to the fact that I'm a historian to that project that I did in fourth grade. I wrote a report on all of the missions. I still remember doing it. I loved it. So interesting. Even if we're not Catholic, if we live here in California, I think it's important for us to engage in a conversation about this upcoming canonization of Junipero Serra. It's part of California heritage, part of our tradition, part of California culture. Now, you've probably read some about Junipero Serra, but I just want to cover some snippets of his life. He was known to be an impressive evangelizer. He was passionate about spreading the Christian faith. And his sermons are full of references to God as mercy. In one Lenten sermon, he wrote, "God is complete mercy, complete love, complete tenderness toward all men, even toward the most ungrateful sinners. The Lord wishes all people to attain ends for which he compassionately created us. The Lord wishes all people to attain the ends for which he compassionately created us." Junipero Serra himself suffered mightily from chronic pain throughout his life. He had an ulcerated leg wound that never healed. And yet he walked thousands of miles in this job he had to found and administer the missions throughout California and Mexico. He developed a spirituality that was centered on this pain and moved into areas that we might find questionable. He pursued self-flagellation and self-mortification in addition to embracing the chronic pain that he felt in his leg. There are many, many stories about how he interacted with Native Americans. For example, among the Chumash Indians who lived in the area of Santa Barbara up north to San Luis Obispo. They were quite taken with the fact that he stood out among the men he traveled with. He was wearing his brown habit, after all, and he had some way about him, we might say, this charisma, that the Chumash noted that he was a special man. They saw that he could not navigate through this muddy area, so they picked him up and carried him through this muddy marsh. Serra was so taken with this that he wrote in his diary, "This served to deepen my compassion that I have felt for quite some time." Therefore, clearly, he was willing to undergo ongoing conversion when he was in ministry with people. He lobbied for social justice, going to Mexico to lobby for legislation with the Spanish governors against the Spanish soldiers who were raping Native American women. So he lobbied for social justice legislation. And the mission system he created enslaved Native Americans who converted. They were no longer, once upon conversion, they were not allowed to leave the mission compounds to go back to their villages where they lived. Corporal punishment was imposed on Indians. Corporal punishment, which was anathema to their native culture. Corporal punishment was imposed on the Native Americans. And European disease, which they had no immunity for, decimated the Indian population. So the picture we have of the legacy and the life of Junipero Serra is complex. He is a complex figure in our California history and in our Christian tradition. To help us come to grips with the complexity of Serra, I'd like to place him within a broader tradition of Christian sanctity. Now, as you know, as Swedenborgian, Swedenborg himself had an ambivalent view of people as saints. He was wary of the notion of sanctity, thinking that in heaven souls would interact with saints and give them undue credit, undue honor. He felt all honor was due to God alone. So Swedenborg himself was really quite wary of anyone being elevated to sanctity. And yet within the broader Christian tradition, we know saints have existed from almost the very beginning of the Christian faith. In the earliest centuries, it was martyrs who were uplifted as saints. Those people during times of persecution who endured torture, who endured persecution for their faith. Stories were written about them, told about them, in order to buoy the faith of others. So they were upheld as role models. Saints were people you imitated. But things changed when Christianity became legal in the 4th century. The tradition of sanctity became much more complex. And in fact, it became more common for saints, holy people, to be written about, spoken about, preached about, as people to admire, but not to imitate. It was known that saints were different and sometimes pursued behavior that was unhealthy and not worthy of imitation. Often, this stipulation of admire, not imitate, was placed on those female saints. Just call two examples to mind. Catherine of Siena, who some of you may have heard about, 14th century eminent preacher and teacher of the faith. But we know that she fasted severely so that many scholars have considered her to be anorexic. Even her own spiritual director said, "Stop it, you gotta eat, you gotta eat." There was no contemporary or subsequent interest in people imitating Catherine as a severe faster. Angela of Foligno from the 13th, 14th century. She's a lay Franciscan woman who was just canonized by Pope Francis last year. She was eminent among her peers. She was considered magister theologorum, that is, master of theologians. Theologians looked to her as their teacher. I call her the Dear Abby of the medieval world because people wrote their letters asking for spiritual advice from her. She was very well respected, very well known, and considered a holy woman. And yet, in her spiritual autobiography, she reveals that upon her conversion, this is shocking, it takes your breath away, she prayed for the death of her family. She felt so caught by that domestic lifestyle she was in. She wanted freedom from these domestic ties, and she prayed for the death of her family. Also in the spiritual autobiography, she reveals that she consumed things that we would not consider food. Not worthy of imitation. And that's not where her spiritual life ended, but this was part of her journey. These are not the reasons for which she was canonized. These were not the reasons for which people thought she was holy, but it was part of her life. She could have chosen not to put that in her spiritual biography. Her amanuensis, the secretary, could have chosen not to copy it down when she was dictating that part, those parts. And the editor of the life, of the spiritual autobiography, could have chosen to take it out. But no, they all kept those raw moments of her life in because it was part of her life story. Again, not the reasons for which she was canonized, not the reasons for which people flocked to her for spiritual advice, but part of her very difficult life of faith. The third part about the tradition of sanctity in the Christian tradition that I just want to highlight, which is kind of obvious for many of us, but this process of canonization is a bureaucratic process. It didn't start until the 11th century. It is a process that privileges those people who have economic and political clout to push these processes through. So it's not surprising that the vast majority of officially canonized saints are either members of royal families or members of religious orders and priests, those people who have institutions behind them to push forward the canonization process. But here's the thing about sanctity. You can be officially canonized and fall quickly into oblivion if the people do not receive the story of your holiness. Public reception of saints' lives, public reception of saints, of holy people, is what makes a saint viable in lives of faith. It's not just the official ceremony. Now, here we are in the early 21st century, and I have to wonder if we are on the cusp of coming to a new appreciation of the role of saints in our lives of faith. One of my favorite spiritual writers right now is Nadia Bowles Weber, who is a Lutheran minister who has a parish in Denver. She has roots here in the Bay Area, studied across the Bay. Her ministry and her congregation is filled with people who feel marginalized and not accepted in many churches. Those people who are homeless, who are addicts, who for whatever reason don't feel welcomed in many congregations, feel welcome in the church that she leads. She has a forthcoming book coming out just next month called Accidental Saints. She writes, "What if that annoying person right next to you was really there with a shot of grace? Yeah, that annoying person that you really don't want to deal with. That person on the parish council, oh, that person's talking again. That person you have to commute with, that coworker. What if they're there with a shot of grace? Something for us to learn. Going out on a limb here, but maybe a lot of us in this room might more be willing to feel the shot of grace coming from someone with an addiction or with a homeless person rather than someone like Junipero Serra. But that's where I'm going with this. Is there any shot of grace that we can get with this upcoming canonization of Junipero Serra? In my final remarks, I want to look for those shots of grace, but with a special attention, noting that he has been called the patron saint of vocations in the Catholic Church. That is, the patron saint of those people going into ordination. Those men, for Catholics, the men who are seeking ordination, or men and women seeking vowed religious life. What is it that they can learn specifically, and what can we all take from the life of Francis, from the tradition of canonization as applied to Francis, and our popular reception of Junipero Serra, Junipero Serra. First of all, I would say, do imitate and admire Sarah's willingness to experience ongoing conversion. Imitate and admire his ability to learn from the people he was in ministry with. Don't imitate Sarah's lack of self-care. Your willingness to endure and inflict pain on yourself may very well lead to your willingness to inflict pain on other people. So don't follow his way of not taking care of his own pain and of adding to his pain with flagellation. Admire his discipline to complete the tasks that he was assigned, and yet at the same time, don't become so excessive that you're unrealistic about what you can do and what the people around you can do. Admire Sarah for his eloquent preaching, especially with regard to emphasizing God's love and his compassion. But do not imitate him in his inability to live out this supreme compassion toward all others, especially those he ministered with. Admire and imitate his political engagement for lobbying for social justice issues for Native Americans, but do not admire or imitate his inconsistencies in allowing a virtual enslavement of Native Americans who converted to the faith. No doubt there are more lessons to be discerned as we move toward this canonization date of September 23rd and beyond, after Sarah is canonized. But just know that the deepest lessons of this canonization will not necessarily be announced in any official canonization proclamation. I think the deepest lessons will be voiced and expressed through the reception of the faithful, what the people make out of this new saint. What I hear people saying is, it's time for ordained leadership to lead with the same compassion they preach. But let's keep the discussion going. More shall be revealed when we engage in this conversation.